Why are we talking about history? Well, first thing I think to appreciate is that religions, on the whole, tend to be very anti-historical. And that is to say that religions tend to tell themselves a narrative, a mythic narrative, and that mythic narrative creates a sense of meaning for the religious community, okay? So if you're a Christian, you tell yourself a story about the death and resurrection of Jesus and so on. If you're a Buddhist, you tell yourself a story about the life of the Buddha, his enlightenment and death and so on. And these stories are very powerful and they move people and they create a sense of meaning and purpose within a community, creates a sense of connection. History challenges that narrative, right? Because history says we have this story, but then we have an independent source of facts which we can use to shake that story, right? And as we know from every facet of our life, everything that we do, when you check the stories that you believe in against the facts, very often you end up having to change your story. Yeah? And this is something which people in religious movements, generally speaking, are very uncomfortable with. So we find the normal state of affairs is that there's quite a large gap between the historical understanding of events around religious leaders, teachers, the time of them, as understood by the academics and scholars in the field, and the historical situation as depicted, or the mythic situation, really, as depicted by people who are part of the religious community. The secret to understanding this is that myth is always about the present, okay? And if you want to understand religious mythology, then you will always get tripped up and always misunderstand things if you take the myth to be what it seems to be, a story about the past, right? But in fact, it's always a story about the present. The reason why is because myths are telling about timeless truths, okay? They're telling about things whose truth is not contingent on individual historical facts. So it's somebody in the present talking about their perception and their understanding of these timeless truths. And this is how mythology works. The problem is when we get what we call religious fundamentalism, which is the idea that this mythology actually translates sort of somehow literally into some historical facts, okay? And in fact, when we look at the myths and we check them against the history, what we typically find is that, well, there are some things in the myths which are historical and some things which are not, okay? That's just how life is. There are some things which are found in the stories which are true, some things which aren't. Okay, so we need to learn in our minds to distinguish this between the facts and the mythology. And especially from a Buddhist point of view, of course, we should never be afraid of the facts. Okay? Buddhism is supposed to be based on reality. Reality is not destroyed by facts. Okay? All that knowing the facts does is it improves our ability to understand reality. It challenges our beliefs. That's what we're supposed to be doing. Right? We're supposed to be coming to a religion like Buddhism, or whatever you call it, a religion or whatever, doesn't really matter, I don't care what you call it, but we're supposed to be coming here because we suffer from dukkha, right? Yes? And we want to do something about it, right? So we want to change, right? We want to do something differently. And we can't change without changing, right? So you can't come to Buddhism and think, I'm going to keep everything, all my beliefs the same, everything's going to remain unchallenged, and then somehow I'm going to transform myself. Right? It doesn't work like that. So when we come to Buddhism, we have to open up everything. We have to make everything available for questioning. All of our assumptions, all the way down, no matter how many tortoises there may be, we keep on going down. Okay? So don't be afraid of the facts. Right? So what we do is when we're doing history is we interrogate the facts, we look at what is the evidence, different kinds of evidence from archaeology, from comparative studies, from all kinds of things from texts and so on. And we take those facts, we look at them, we sift through them, we sort them, and we interpret them. Now, the results of that interpretation are always uncertain, and they're always subject to change. And they're especially uncertain and subject to change when we're dealing with events which are so remote and so little known as ancient India. And we argue out about, and you know, you read in the newspaper and they're always arguing about what's happening in the Liberal Party headquarters, right? I mean, this is here and now. This is people who talk to the media every day and people who are on Twitter and Facebook telling everybody what they think and so on. And we have so much information, and yet still nobody can agree about what's actually happening. And still, we only have a tiny proportion of the narrative. And think how much more so that's the case in ancient India. We have a tiny, tiny, tiny few scraps and a few fragments. So we can never be really certain about what's happened, right? At the very least, right, the very minimum that we can do is to say, let us not throw away the few facts that we do have, okay? Let's take those things which are reasonably certain and actually take account of those and use that as our bedrock. And from there, we can see what's possible to build up from that. So we should never see that history as being something which is challenging the Dhamma. It may well be challenging our interpretation of the Dhamma. It may be challenging our practices. It may be challenging what we've learned and heard before from our culture, our tradition, and so on and so forth. It should do those things. That's the point of it. Okay, so don't expect to be unchallenged, right? Doesn't mean that the mythology is useless. It means that it has its use as a mythology, right? The stories of the Buddha are meaningful and powerful stories as stories. But then the question about what is the historical basis of them is a separate issue. Okay? So this is why when we're coming to look at the teachings of the Buddha, we should not think that when I'm talking about mythology, right? I don't just mean the traditional myths which are created and handed down by the schools of Buddhism, like the life of the Buddha and the Jatakas and these kinds of things. Of course, that's a mythology, but I'm also thinking of the mythology that we create in our own minds, right? We create in our minds in modern times, either individually or culturally, a narrative around Buddhism which tells a certain story about that. And just like any mythology, that narrative will... It actually expresses our concerns in the present, okay? And we project those concerns into the past. And we can see this happening constantly. It happens all the time in Buddhist studies, right? That we find that these present-day issues are projected onto the past. I'll just give you one simple example of that. If you go to most pages on Buddhism on Wikipedia, you'll find that it'll give often a Pali term for a Buddhist term in the Roman script, and then it will give the Pali term in Devanagari script, okay? And people think that Devanagari is kind of like the real Pali language, right? And people even spoke to someone the other day who even like had a tattoo done on his arm in Devanagari, because that's like the real language. But of course, historically, Pali has never been written in Devanagari, okay? And the reason why it's on all the pages on Wikipedia is because of the Hindutva extremists who come onto Wikipedia and keep on putting these things in Pali in order to create the impression that Buddhism really is a kind of Hinduism, right? And even though the Pali Buddhist scholars go on there again and again and again and again and remove them because it's anti-historical, right? It gets put back again and again and again and again. Right? So this is like creating this narrative that shifts towards a certain perspective of what kind of Indian history was and so on. So let us not fall into that trap. Let us not feel fear at facts. Let's rejoice in facts. Let us be grateful for the fact that people have done a lot of work, right? Going around India and digging stuff up, my goodness, it's hard enough to go around India and just sit in a train and wander from your hotel to the tourist site and back again, right? That's hard work enough, right? But to go around and do these archaeological excavations, to learn to read all these ancient texts, to actually spend all the time to do all that research, it's hard, long work with little reward, okay? No one's getting paid very much to do this stuff. So we should have great gratitude for the people who have done all this work and that they've actually given us a picture of India in the time of the Buddha, which is actually quite fascinating and which enriches our understanding of the Dhamma and throws a new light on so many passages that we can read in the suttas. Okay? Questions on that before we move on? Okay. So a few things, just very basic things about ancient Indian history. First thing, ancient India was not Hindu. Okay, it should be completely superfluous to say this, but apparently it's still quite controversial. Just to clarify what I mean by that is that there's a stream of Indian religious and spiritual thought which harks back to the Vedas, which is a very ancient text and which were prominent in India for a long time before the time of the Buddha. But the Vedas are not the same as what we think of today as Hinduism. And if the relationship between those things seems confusing to you, then think about, say, the relationship between the Catholic Church and the, Old Testament, especially the early books of the Old Testament, the books of Genesis and so on, right? So this is part of the same religious tradition, right? They're not entirely separate by any means, right? And yet you'd never say that Noah and Abraham were Catholics, okay? They were Jews or Hebrews or whatever word you want to use for the people practicing at that time. They never heard of Catholicism. And in the same way, the Brahmins who were in the time of the Buddha had never heard of Ganesh or Skanda or Vishnu or Shiva or temples or Kali or so many other things which we take to be basic to what Hinduism is. Right? Mahabharata didn't exist, Ramayana didn't exist, and on and on and on. So many things which we take to be basic to Hinduism didn't exist in the time of the Buddha, but more importantly, what didn't exist in the time of the Buddha was the synthesis, okay? Hinduism, if it is anything, is a synthesis, right? It takes elements of the Vedas, of the philosophies from different philosophers and contemplatives, from village-level religion, town-level religion, different gods and so on, everything all over India, and you wrap it up into one big thing, and you say, this is what we call Hinduism, right? That synthesis didn't exist. Many of the elements in there did, right? But nobody thought of them as being part of the same religion, right? In this village over here, people would worship this yakka. In that town over there, the Brahmins would do their rituals. Over here, these ascetics were doing their practices. And nobody thought that there was any particular connection between these, right? They weren't considered to be part of Hinduism. They were just different religious things that people were doing. And it was only 1,000 years later that the synthesis started to happen with the great philosophers like Shankara and so on, who brought all of these things under this sort of magnificent Advaita philosophy which he developed at that time. So this is one thing which is important to clear our minds of and to remember that, yes, there were many elements of Brahmanism, Vedism and so on, which are carried over into modern Hinduism, but the religious practices of people at the time is not identical with what we understand as Hinduism today. Okay, this is a historical fact, which was established very clearly by the Indologists in the late 19th century. It's been known as a fact for 150 years by any historian in the subject, and yet is still obscured, again, largely because of the persistent mythologies which are constructed by the Hindutva scholars who sort of try to argue that the Buddha was a Hindu and so on. Okay, in thinking about ancient Indian history, one of the most fundamental categories that we use to think about this is the distinction between Shramanas and Brahmins. Okay, The Brahmins are the priests, but they come down. How do you say? They come from the mouth of God, but they have like their lineage by birth.
Hereditary.
Thank you. Yes, hereditary priesthood. So it's like a priesthood caste determined by their birth and their clan and so on. And they inherit like a sacred knowledge, which is part of their family lore and their family customs. And they perform various roles. Initially, it would have been purely ceremonial roles. Later on, as philosophers, contemplatives, and so on. Actually, many Brahmins just were farmers and merchants and things like that. They did all kinds of roles, but their sort of spiritual role was also quite important. And the Brahmins were always contrasted in ancient India with the Shramanas in Sanskrit, or Samanas in Pali. And the Shramanas were kind of a breakaway, not a breakaway movement, they were a heterodox movement who rejected all of the things that the Brahmins stood for. They rejected the authority of the Vedas, they rejected the Brahmin caste system, they rejected the efficacy of the rituals, and so on. And they proposed their own philosophy, typically being a philosophy which they believed that they could work out for themselves. So they were much more independent thinkers or philosophers or contemplatives who came up with new ideas, rejecting the old orthodoxy. So these two streams. And interestingly, in the later grammar of Patanjali, a couple of hundred years after the Buddha, he's discussing the various kinds of compounds in Sanskrit. And one compound he cites is a Shramana Brahmana as a compound, which is a kind of compound called a Dwanda. And so a Dwanda compound means essentially you can break it up as and, right? Samanas and Brahmins. But he cites this as a Dwanda compound where the two elements are constantly in conflict with each other. Okay? So this was the byword, right? That they were always these two elements and they were always arguing with each other, the Samanas and the Brahmins. The Buddha, of course, always identified himself in a socio-cultural sense with the Shramanas, okay? He used the term Brahmana, as so many of the terms he used, in a completely different sense. Rather than in a caste-based hereditary sense, he used it in a sense of being somebody who's spiritually purified and spiritually awakened. The oldest roots we have in Indian history, really, although actually probably more prehistory, but in terms of Indian civilization, is what we call the Indus Valley Civilization. And this is an extensive civilization. The roots of it are Indian rather than being imported. It was often formerly thought that it was imported from like Mesopotamia and so on, who had cities shortly before the Indus Valley. But more recent discoveries in the town of Meghar have shown that there's actually a slow development of towns and civilization from about 7000 BC. So it's a little bit later than the development of civilization in the Mesopotamian region, which started about 10 or 11,000 BC, but not that much later. And the Indus Valley cities were contemporary with the great cities of ancient Mesopotamia, and there was trade between them. This gives you an idea of the Indus Valley, the extent of the Indus Valley civilization. In its mature phase, 2600 to 1900 BC, very large civilization. In fact, there are also isolated settlements even further down on the Ganges, Yamuna. And throughout that whole region is characterized by an unbelievable degree of uniformity, cultural uniformity, particularly town planning. Each of the cities and towns in that region is built according to essentially an identical plan, which is extremely highly organized with running water, sewerage, and all of these kinds of things. And you look at that and you're thinking, what happened? like seriously. And for that long period of time, 2600 to roughly 1900 BC, so it's a mature phase. The whole extent of the phase was longer, but that's the height of it. You know, and it was very peaceful during that whole time. There's very little records of war or anything like that. It's a very unusual civilization in many ways. In a lot of ways, it's very similar to other Neolithic civilizations, like you find in Babylon and Egypt and so on. But in some ways, it's very different. No records of war and things like that. But also, no palaces, no temples, no kind of grand architecture, right? Which is, of course, very interesting. You know, usually in those things, you found this, like you had the pyramids or something like that. You could see how these would be like symbols of power, right? They kind of exert a fascination over the mind, and they show you what the guys who are running this place, right, are serious, yeah. And you know, this is how power works, doesn't it? You set up these symbols so that kind of magnetizes your mind. It's set up this charisma. Indus Valley didn't really have anything like that. I mean, yeah, there was a bit of difference between, you know, houses that looked a bit richer than others and so on, but not all that much. There's a couple of places that may have been temples or something like that. There's what looks like this area here is one of the main ones. It's like a ritual bath. And you can see a bit of a structure there, but, you know, it's not huge. This one is obviously a tank of some kind, and you can see this is very much a precursor of the kind of tanks you see all over India and Sri Lanka even today. The same rectangular pattern, steps going down into it and so on. It may have been used for ritual bathing, okay, but that's purely speculative. We don't really know anything about it. And, you know, you can see a little bit of a glimpse there, the very kind of regular building patterns. Again, you can see the idea of using thick brick walls was very similar to the later Buddhist architecture that you see throughout, like Nalanda and other places, the use of the red brick. So this was earlier phases in the Indus Valley were unfired brick, the later phases were fired brick. Afterwards, then there was a gap, everything fell apart, and there was a long period, nearly 1,000 years before they started using brick again. We know little of the religions and culture of the Indus Valley civilization, but here is one of the more intriguing cultural finds. This is one of what they call the Indus Valley seals. And these are small little things, a bit similar. They're a bit like the amulets that you find today in Thai Buddhism. Right? They're about that big. And they're very, like, you know, you can imagine something that small, right? And the level of detail in the carving. Yeah, so these are extremely finely and very beautifully carved. If you see the originals made out of soapstone or clay, very, very fine craftsmanship. And some of the, you know, we don't have any large-scale works from the Indus Valley, but quite a lot of smaller ones. And some of them, the artistry is as good as anything you find in ancient Greece. This one is very famous. This is known as the Pashupati or the Proto-Shiva image. And it's often argued that this fellow here is a deity who is the prototype of Shiva or Rudra from the Rig Vedas. It's a claim which is not implausible. Shiva was always the kind of the horned god, and he was also the lord of animals, Pashupati, and he was also the ascetic or the meditator. So it certainly has some similarities with how Shiva was depicted in later times, but there's a big gap, right? I mean, this is like 1000 or 1500 BC or 2000 BC or something, and the first descriptions of Shiva in that way are like 500 AD. Or maybe a bit earlier than that, maybe 200 AD or 500 AD. So you're talking like, you know, 1500 year or 2000 year gap. Maybe there's a historical connection, but it's certainly not obvious that there is. Up here you see the some signs, and these are the writing system of the Indus Valley. The writing system is as yet undeciphered. Lots of people have tried very hard to decipher them, but it's extremely difficult to decipher because the vocabulary of signs is quite large. There's several hundred of these signs, and the texts are extremely short. And so this is a fairly typical one, right? So there's a few signs, not much context, not much to go on in terms of understanding what they are. And so there's been very little progress in terms of deciphering this thing. We don't even really know what language family the language was, or even actually if it's a writing system. There are some people who argue that it's not a writing system at all. Any questions? No? Barbara?
When the Buddha was enlightened and he was tempted, which was it Brahma was supposed to come and ask him to do something or other?
That's right, yeah.
So that Brahma, where does he figure in the not Hindu?
Yeah, well, the concept of Brahma, of course, is fundamental in the whole, you know, Vedic Hindu stream, right? So from the earliest time. So this is one of the elements shared in common. But the way that Brahma is talked about is in several, in quite a lot of different kinds of ways. But the most obvious difference between being a personal Brahma and the impersonal Brahma. And the Upanishads usually have an impersonal one, whereas the Buddhist texts usually talk about a personal Brahma. But still, that's obviously meant to be the kind of deity of the Brahmanical tradition. Yeah. Of course, in mature Hinduism, you always have the idea that the Trimurti, the three gods, who Brahma, Shiva, and Vishnu. Whereas in the time of the suttas, Shiva and Vishnu are effectively nowhere to be seen. So it's just Brahma. It's not uncommon. There's a number of images. There's several thousand of these seals. Okay, most of them depict animals, and a few depict things that have some kind of possibly religious significance. And there's a few, I think maybe three or four, that seem to depict someone sitting in a yoga posture or meditation posture like that. Yeah. We'll come to that in just a minute. Yeah.
What year were the Vedas?
Again, we'll come to that, and we haven't got to the Vedas yet. We're still in the Indus Valley. Yes?
If it's not writing up the top left, what is it?
Yeah, good question. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you think about something like, say, hieroglyphs, where you have like an evolution, or say Chinese writing, where you have an evolution from pictograms to writing. Now these, because they're extremely variable, like there's about 600 of them, these signs. So there's a lot more than you'd expect for like a phonetically based writing system. So all the later Indian kinds of writing are basically phonetic. So they're a bit similar to the English system. So basically one sign equals one letter. So you have a kind of same number of letters, maybe 50 or so, right? Whereas if you have like Chinese, then each pictogram is an idea, right? So then you have like 50,000 or something, right? Whereas this is uncomfortably in between, right? It's there's too many for them to be representing sounds, but not enough for them to be representing words, right? So then it becomes, this is why it's difficult for linguists to really kind of classify it. Yeah, I mean, I think the majority position is still that it is a writing system, probably, or at least the beginnings of one. But it was challenged by some quite serious scholars a few years ago. If it's not a writing system, it may be a kind of symbol shorthand. And of course, we don't know how these things were being used. So again, that makes it very difficult to know. One thing that they might have done, if, for example, what it might do is something like, it might be something like a mark of authority, right? So like a signature, exactly. So it might be, you might use it for trade or other purposes, right? So it might signify your family. So you have like animals, and so frequently families might have an animal as a totem. And then perhaps the signs might represent some kind of like your family tradition or what your affiliations are or something like that. So yeah, but I guess that's highly kind of speculative, but but you know, it's an important cultural thing. I mean, there's thousands of these things, right? And there's obviously a lot of care and effort and craftsmanship that went into them. So it's not a
Yeah. Population being
that time, I can probably, Wikipedia is probably going to be a friend. Let me just see. Did it? Sorry, I missed that. Where did you see that? Okay, there you go. At its peak, the Indus Valley may have had a population of over 5 million. Inhabitants of the ancient Indus River Valley developed new techniques in handicraft, metallurgy, copper, bronze, lead, and tin, not yet iron. And they're noted for their urban planning, baked brick houses, elaborate draining systems, water supply systems, and clusters of large non-residential buildings. So this obviously is you know, sophisticated cities. There must have been government, right, and a fairly effective bureaucracy to be able to do that, and not just in one town, but over a large area to be able to repeat that same kind of, you know, pattern. You've got obviously in a very efficient sort of communication and social control system of some kind, but we have no idea really how that worked. We don't know. Some people say he's an archetype of Shiva, but we don't really know. It could be a god. It could be like a. I mean, obviously it's someone fairly impressive, right? This is not like Joe down the corner selling fish, right? So maybe a king, a lord, maybe a priest or ascetic or some kind of ritual figure, maybe a depiction of a deity. Yeah, hard to say. Yeah, but, you know, you do have these very regal figures. You know, a lot of some of the figurines from the Indus Valley, you know, they convey a sense of, you know, this very beautiful pottery. You know, craftsmanship is astonishing, right? See, that's old, right? 2500 BC, 5,000 years old. See, this is again a classic one. This fellow is. Again, looks like quite a regal figure, doesn't he? You know, he conveys a sense of authority. It's like he's not messing around with this guy, you know. And
what's so interesting is that the right shoulder.
He's got his robe over his left shoulder and his right shoulder beard. Yeah.
Interesting on his forehead, the symbol.
That's right, yes, yeah. So he's got a headband with a thing there, a beard. You know, and there's definitely continuity. You know, you see another one of the very striking images is so here we see some of the other seals with the animals on them, the elephants and so on. So these ones are very common. This one is a classic, the dancing girl. And she's, sassy is word that comes to mind. Right? And, you know, she's got attitude. And, but she's also got armbands. Right? So you can see she still has the bangles, which you see all Indian women still wear today. It's just a name that they give. Yeah, she could be. Yeah, she could be anything. Yeah, I mean, some of the things there are like children's toys, like toy carts and things like that. So yeah, it's pretty amazing. The symbols. Anyway, I don't want to spend too long on the Indus Valley. You can check out Wikipedia, or whatever, and have a look at there. But just so you know, this is some of the this is some of the sort of background for the for the time of the Buddha. Of course, around about 1500 or so BC, the Indus Valley was in rapid decline. And that can be seen from the archaeological evidence. And it's not entirely clear exactly what the decline was caused by, but usually the best case is because of climate change. The river systems, like all the ancient civilizations in Egypt and Mesopotamia and so on, it was dependent on the river systems and the regular annual flooding and so on. And as long as those systems were predictable and regular, then it could flourish. And obviously, it flourished for a long time, right? Well over 1,000 years. But then it seems that the rivers dried up, and with satellite imagery and so on, they've shown that the rivers changed course and so on. And it seems that created enough social unrest and so on that the civilization went into decline. If I remember correctly, I think in the later strata of it, you find like weapons and signs of violence appearing that you didn't have before. At a certain point, the Aryan peoples arrived and essentially displaced the Harappan or Indus Valley culture. And we don't know, again, we're not entirely clear what the relationship between those two strata of culture is. But we've been talking for a while now. Let's just sit and have a meditation for a few minutes to clear our minds.